We often talk in this program about how money can gain you access to decision makers, but you might be amazed at some of the other things that you can buy, like a prison cell upgrade or a license to shoot an endangered black rhinoceros. And if you have a $500,000, you don't have to enter the U.S. illegally. You can buy the right to immigrate. In his latest book, Michael J. Sandel, Harvard University's Anne T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government and author of the international bestseller Justice, has called his latest book, What Money Can Buy, and the list seems to be shrinking. His book is What Money Can't Buy, I'm sorry, and that list seems to be shrinking. I messed that up. Sorry. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Great to be with you.
Your subtitle is The Moral Limits of Markets. Are you questioning the morality of free market capitalism in this book?
Not free market capitalism as such, but what I am saying is we need to have a public debate about where markets serve the public good and where they don't belong. It's really a book about keeping markets in their place and noticing there's been a kind of market creep and invasion of all spheres of life in the last three decades.
And even now, post-2008, when we talk about morality in markets, we think about the deceptive practices of some Wall Street firms or Bernie Madoff or regulatory reform. What are you talking about when you talk about the moral limits of markets?
Something bigger, but also something more mundane and pervasive than the financial industry or Wall Street. It's about the tendency, if you step back and look at it, the tendency of markets and market thinking to reach into spheres of life traditionally governed by other values, non-market norms, from health to education to civic life. And it's really amazing, if you look at it, how many things today, almost everything, can be bought and sold.
But don't most economists believe markets are without moral implication?
Well, economists often present their discipline as value neutral. They're simply telling us how efficiently to allocate goods. That's always been a dubious claim, I think. But today, when economics has vastly increased its ambition to be a science of decision in general, a science of incentives, economics today no longer deals only with flat screen televisions and material goods. It also purports to be able to explain family life, personal relations, health, education, whether people should stick with their spouses or get a divorce. It's the economic theory of human behavior. It's really enlarged its ambition. And once economics gets into all spheres of social life, it's really very difficult to believe it can be value neutral, and I don't think it can be.
Is the foundation of the market economy the idea that the market will place a fair price on everything? Isn't that what economists have? Well, some, not every economist. There are any number of leading dissenters.
There are dissenters. But the dominant view, the mainstream view, is that so long as there is a deal, an exchange between consenting adults, the market price that results from that deal is fair.
And Humphrey Bogart was asked why he deserved to be paid as much as he was for a picture, and he said, because I can get it. And it's the same sort of thing that star athletes say, reasonably. And isn't that the justification of a market economy?
Well, that is the standard justification, but there's no reason to assume that the distribution of income and wealth that results from a market economy is fair simply because it results from buying and selling. It's a further question. It's a question of justice, whether that's fair.
So what kinds of things are for sale today that would have been unthinkable 30 years ago?
Well, take the examples you mentioned at the outset, being able to buy a prison cell upgrade. There is advertising now in prisons, commercial advertising, also in schools, on the sides of school buses, but even in the classroom. In some schools, there's an attempt, there are experiments to try to motivate children, school children, to get good grades or to score well on standardized tests by offering them cash incentives.
Does it work?
Well, it's had a very mixed result. In New York City schools, it didn't work very well. In Dallas, they pay third graders $2 for each book they read as a way of trying to get kids, it's understandable, to read more books. There it has worked. Kids are reading more books, though the books they read are becoming shorter, not surprisingly. But there's a bigger question. Apart from whether it works in the short term, the real question is, what kind of message is this sending about why you should read? Isn't there the risk that we're sending children the message that reading is a chore that you get paid for? And if that's what they learn, what becomes of the larger purpose of education, which is to cultivate a love of learning? That's the risk that the use of financial incentives in cases like education will crowd out other attitudes and norms that we care about and want to cultivate in children.
Well, let's talk about that prison cell upgrade. In the past, if you were a powerful figure, you got a better cell. You usually bribed somebody. You might have even gotten kitchen privileges and whatever else. So isn't selling it actually a more moral approach?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that we called it a bribe. It was clearly a bribe in the old days.
Yeah.
But is it any less a bribe if people can, in full public view, be given the option of buying a better, safer prison cell? Is it a bribe? Maybe it is still a bribe, even if it's not done illicitly. Whether it's a bribe depends on really how we conceive the purpose of jails and prisons and should they be sold, should upgrades be sold. You could consider, for that matter, college admissions. Now, in the old days, I suppose, and some would say today that it's possible that a wealthy donor has an edge in getting his or her son or daughter into a university. But should the universities, as a matter of policy, put a certain percentage of the seats in the freshman class up for auction? Most of us would hesitate at that idea. Even if it were open and public, it would still be a kind of bribe, and that's because it's really at odds with the purpose. Distributing by money is at odds, I think, with the purpose of higher education.
But this also leads us into another area, the difference between a fine and a fee.
Right.
And that's related, isn't it?
It is.
What have we discovered? There was a case of a study of child care centers in Israel.
Yes.
That is quite fascinating.
Right. They had the problem that all daycare centers have, parents coming late to pick up their children. So they instituted, with the help of some economists, a fine if you came late to pick up your child. The result was more parents came late. Now, standard economic reasoning says if you put a price on a good, if you make it more expensive, fewer people will opt for that good. But what happened was the norms and attitudes were displaced by the monetary payment. The parents treated the fine as if it were a fee for hiring the teacher to stay longer. And what this shows is that sometimes market values, market exchange can crowd out non-market norms, non-market values.
This goes against another idea that many economists believe, that markets don't touch or taint the goods that they regulate.
Right. If we're just talking about flat-screen televisions, whether I buy it or whether you give it to me as a gift, the television is the same. It still works, assuming it's a good one. But suppose we're talking about paying kids to read or persuading parents to come to pick up their children on time. There, putting a monetary value on the good changes the meaning of the good, and so it changes our attitude toward the good. So it's a mistake. Once markets reach into the non-material sphere, beyond flat-screen televisions, then we have to ask, where will bringing money into the picture actually change the character of the goods, whether education or health or citizenship, for that matter?
Well, how does Finland issue speeding tickets?
Right. That's an example that I ran across.
You were speeding in Finland?
No, I wasn't speeding. But I read about it. the world's biggest speeding fine. Do you know how much it was? $217,000 in Finland. And that's because they tie the fine to your income, to your ability to pay. It should be proportional, they think. Now, this is a way of making clear that a speeding fine is not just a fee for driving fast if you want to. It's a moral judgment. There's some opprobrium. The society is saying, we don't want you to do this. It's, you know, it's like we have a fine if you throw litter onto the highway driving by. But suppose someone said, gee, I really want to get rid of this McDonald's wrapper. It's worth it to me to pay for the benefit of using the highway as a dumpster. We would still consider that person did something wrong, even though he or she was willing to pay the cost. So a fine reflects moral opprobrium. We don't want people to do that, even if they're willing to pay the price. A fee is different.
Didn't the American economist Kenneth Balding propose a system of marketable procreation licenses as early as 1964?
Exactly. He came up. He applied standard economic reasoning to the question of population control.
His approach was different than what the Chinese government did?
Well, the Chinese make it a law. They limit a population to one child or two in some cases. And what's happening in China now is some affluent couples who want more than one child say, we're willing to pay. We'll pay the fine. They regard it as a fee to have an extra child. And the economist, Balding, whom I quote in the book, said much earlier than this, he said the efficient way, the economically efficient way to limit the population is to give each woman or each couple a voucher for one child and allow couples to buy and sell these vouchers on the market. In a way, you know, it's like the tradable emissions permits that we use in some instances for trying to regulate greenhouse gas emissions.
Where you can release one metric ton of carbon for just $18.
That's on the European carbon market. But the broader question, all of these examples raise the procreation, tradable procreation permits or the tradable emissions permits, is whether using the market may buy efficiency but at a price, at a moral price. And the moral price may be leading us to regard emissions or littering as something we can buy if we want to, as luxury goods that we can simply pay for, rather than as things we have duties to avoid.
Now, weren't you chosen by Chinese Newsweek as the most influential foreign figure? Judging from the latest scandals coming out of China, you may be admired, but not always heeded.
Well, I would be the last to claim that I'm heeded in China or any place else. But it's I think that was the result of that. We did an experiment. Harvard made my course on justice the first Harvard course to be offered freely available online everywhere. It was an experiment in open access. And they've been watching it in various places around the world, including in China, where it's become popular on the internet. And so I think that was what lay behind it. The students are engaged. It doesn't mean that I have any influence on what the government does there or here, for that matter.
My guest is Michael J. Sandel, Harvard University's Anne T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government. His latest book is What Money Can't Buy. It's from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael J. Sandel. His latest book is follow-up to his international bestseller, Justice is What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You have a chapter about cutting lines, but haven't people always been able to buy their way to the front of the line?
Not to the degree that it's possible today.
But giving a tip to the maitre d'
right.
is just that sort of thing, isn't it?
Well, that is true. But giving the tip to the maitre d', that was something that's always regarded as something you've got to do discreetly. They don't put a sign in the restaurant window saying, for $50, you can get immediate seating. It's regarded as quasi-illicit. But today, the idea of paying to get to the head of the line is increasingly publicly accepted. Should we talk about some examples?
Well, airlines, for example.
Well, there's a good one.
They're short of money. Yeah. Security is time-consuming.
Right.
So isn't it fair for people who pay more for first-class or business-class tickets to be given special treatment?
Well, special treatment on the flight, drinks and better meals,
oh, sure. But they're seated first, even though they're seated in the front, and it makes it more inconvenient for the rest of us, the poor folks who are coming in later, to be able to get to our seats.
Well, fair enough. But I think there is a distinction between letting people who pay more board earlier and have various conveniences, earlier access to the overhead, luggage racks, and so on. That's part of the service that an airline provides. I think it's a closer call, though, when you get to pay extra to go to the head of the line for the security check. And the difference is, sure, I mean, it's great convenience. But the security check, the purpose of it, is to protect the entire public. It's really for national security to protect against a terrorist attack. Do we want that to be one of the perks, like free drinks or early boarding, that the airlines can sell? I think that's a closer call.
And they're doing that now?
They are routinely, not only if you fly first class, but if you fly coach but don't want to wait in the long security line. You can buy it as an a la carte perk now with many of the airlines.
They also charge you extra to sit in the exit row.
That's true.
There's more leg room.
That's true. But that's different. It's somewhat different, don't you think?
But in the past, that was just a nuisance row because you were the one who had to promise to help everybody get out. How about paying someone to stand in line for you? One of my producers was trying to buy a Nintendo Y a few years ago at Christmas, and the store at Fifth Avenue got a shipment every morning, and every night a line formed at the door, and at the front of it, sleeping there through the night, were some homeless people who would then would sell their service.
Right. It's a form of ticket scalping, and ticket scalping goes way back. Outside every World Series game or sold-out playoff game, there are people scalping tickets. That's familiar. But it raises larger moral and social questions depending on what the line is for. Here's a small example. Shakespeare in the Park is meant to be free public theater. And yet there are people who sell their services as line standers and offer to sell, this was a few years ago, for $125 per free ticket, the tickets that they would stand in line for. The public theater didn't like this. They said the whole point of this is it's free. It's a civic celebration, really. It's a gift that the city gives itself. I think that was the idea. And that's tainted somewhat if the ability to pay or to hire a line stander governs it. But here's I think, even a more troubling example, Leonard. On Capitol Hill, to get into a congressional hearing, the seats are scarce. Some of those hearings are popular. Lobbyists, of course, want to sit in on the hearings, but they don't want to stand in line. So there are now line-standing companies in Washington that specialize in hiring homeless people and others to wait in lines, and then they sell this service to lobbyists at a big markup, and the lobbyist can take his or her place in the line just before the hearing begins. They also do it at the Supreme Court to get into to hear the oral arguments. Paid line standing, it's different. It's different from paying to, I think, board first, isn't it?
I would go along with that. What is Project Prevention, and what kind of reaction has that program inspired?
Well, this is another example of using market incentives, cash incentives, to serve otherwise understandable, legitimate goals. It's a charitable group that wants to deal with the problem of babies born to drug-addicted mothers. The way they go about it, though, is they offer $300 to any drug-addicted woman who is willing to undergo sterilization or long-term birth control.
This brings us back to the whole concept of eugenics, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It smacks of eugenics. Now, pure free market advocates might say this is different from eugenics to the extent that it's not the government mandating anything. It's not forced sterilization. It's a free choice. It's a free market choice whether to accept that $300. But, of course, the reply to that is, well, first, how free is that choice, really, to an impoverished or drug-addicted person? And beyond the freedom question, how genuine is the consent, isn't there something morally troubling about inviting women to give up, to relinquish their reproductive capacity for money, for $300? So this is another example of where pure standard economic reasoning about efficiency and free markets may lead to morally questionable territory when applied beyond material goods.
But should I assume that even the most fervent proponents of a market economy recognize that there are some things that cannot and should not be bought and sold?
Well, they do, but many pure free market economists, Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize winning economist at the University of Chicago is an example, they mainly argue that economic reasoning can be applied to everything.
Traffic in humans?
Well, not slavery, mm-hmm. because the slave doesn't have a choice.
Well, sex slavery
is
out there.
Prostitution and sex slavery would be one difficult test to put to people who hold this view. Here's another. What about voting? Why shouldn't there, according to the standard economic logic, market reasoning, why should we not have a free market in votes? Half the people don't even use their votes.
They've always been paid to vote for a certain party.
Well, why shouldn't we allow? Now, again, it's like the maitre d', the tip to the maitre d'. Back in the days of Tammany Hall, money changed hands, and around the world today, money changes hands. And goodness knows the system of campaign finance we currently have comes pretty close to buying and selling votes. But even most free market economists would hesitate to endorse the notion of an outright public market in votes. And I think the reason they would hesitate, though they wouldn't put it this way, I think the reason we would all hesitate is we really don't think that a vote is a piece of private property, but it's a public trust. It's a civic duty.
Well, what about my kidney? That's private property.
Is it?
It's mine. Can I sell it?
Well, in the U.S., you can't sell it. There are some places in the world where you can. And this is a good example of a controversial question about where markets should go. And the question is whether, from the standpoint of pure freedom of choice, the answer is clear, yes. But is there something, do we want to encourage people to regard their bodies as commodities, as marketable goods?
A listener writes, and we don't have much time, does healthcare really work in a capitalist market when there's no limit to what we are willing to pay to live and not die? Doesn't that keep the free market from working correctly?
Well, healthcare is a place, I think, where we have to observe certain limits to the pure free market principle. The healthcare debate, we saw some of those arguments. And the real question is whether access to healthcare should be based on the ability to pay, or whether we believe as a society that everyone should have access to decent health care.
And where do you stand on that?
The second, I think very much the second. But the broader point is that on all of these issues, Leonard, I think we need to have a public debate about where markets do serve the public good and where they don't belong. And that is not a debate we've had in recent years.
Michael Sandel will be speaking tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. For more information about that and about tickets, you can visit our show page. And by the way, no paying anybody for standing online for you to get those tickets. His book is called What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.